about is really an experimental system, and the only experimental system we know where topological phases actually exist in nature. And I want to talk specifically about a particular place within that, and that area, of course, as you know, the fractional polynomial effect, a particular state, the nu equals phi phi state, which you probably heard about yesterday, which is believed to have, or hoped to have, non-abelian, the quantum particles non-abelian statistics. Now, what I have been trying to focus on is really is the interface between topology and geometry. I'm, you know, trained as a physicist where we have length scales and time scales, and topology with none of those kind of makes me a little bit nervous. Where have they all gone? But fortunately, the edge of these fractional quantum Hall states has dynamics. It has velocities, times, and lengths. And I do actually think that the interface between, the metaphorical interface between a topological state, and particularly one where this is chiral, and the gapless edge state is an interesting arena to think about, and this probably hasn't been explored as much as it might. Because, of course, all of the topological properties in the bulk are actually encoded in the dynamics of the chiral conformal field theory that lives on the edge. another reason to really think about the edge is that's where experimentalists can access and measure what's going on inside these fractional quantum Hall effect states. I mean, there are other ways to do that indirectly with a scanning probes, which can measure charge capacitively. And in fact, the fractional charge, the one-third fractional charge in Laughlin's state has been measured that way. But the vast majority of experiments have been transport experiments where current is pushed into the edge, it's backscattered into other edges, and it's measured. Basically, the resistances and conductances are measured.
Can you expand on candidate and believed to be?
Well, do you want my opinion, or do you want, I mean, what do you, anybody's? We can take a vote among those. Actually, let's do that. Among those who actually have an opinion, which might mean something based on something, I don't know, whatever it is, if you feel your opinion has some, basis in some sort of rationality, then please vote. If you don't, then just keep your hands down. So, okay, so the question is, does the nu equals phi house quantum Hall state that's observed in gallium arsenide other structures have quasi-particle excitations with non-abelian statistics? Yes or no? And I think that's, Okay, so how many people say yes? I really should count, actually.
Matthew, this is not a scientific poll. People came to this conference are prone to disagree.
Okay, well, how many people say no? There's probably not going to be anybody.
No, I decided to be contrary.
Okay. I think it's a very biased audience. people who want to believe.
Yeah, I want to let.
They want to believe. Now, I mean, I'm not, my worry is that we won't know for a long time, experimentally. And that's the real worry for me, is that 10 years from now, we won't know whether the answer to that question is yes or no. And so I think there's an awful lot of experimental work that needs to be done, and there's a need for contact between physicists and those experimentalists, theoretical physicists, to push that forward.
If the theory is strong enough, then you don't have to feel so uncertain about things. I mean, for instance, it could be a backside of the moon type of question. On a theoretical ground, you can suppose that the side of the moon, you can't see it, looks a lot like the side of the moon. You can't see it. Experimental confirmation is a long way away.
Just to represent Ed, who Ed
the numerical evidence for this being true is actually very, very strong. I'm very surprised.
Okay. But so this is experimental mathematics, right?
Yeah.
A theorem.
Yeah.
Okay.
But what you know, what actually I think is not understood, you know, theoretically at any sort of level, is really is the detail structure of the edge. I mean, some of the topological features, the topological features of the edge are largely dictated by the topological character of the bulk. So if the bulk actually has a topological character that we all hope it does, there's kind of a minimal number of edge modes that have to live on the edge. But there's very important parameters, like how quickly those edge modes, what are their velocities, and actually what are their directions, and you know, and which edge are you looking at? The edge of the nu equals 5 halves to nu equals 2, or the edge of 5 halves to nu equals 3, or the edge of 5 halves to nu equals 0. I mean, so each of these has its own potential interesting character, or complication, if you will. So it's really, it's you know, what I'm trying to do is basically trying, you know, really help out the experimentalists a little bit to think about, you know, what are the implications for things they can actually measure under the assumption that the nu equals 5 halves is the, you know, Mori, you know, state. Okay, so I think Chaitin mentioned, and perhaps others yesterday, that a point contact when you have edge states running back and forth is a useful can be a useful diagnostic, and you know, ultimately multiple point contacts perhaps would be needed to measure these non-linear statistics and so forth. So what I want to talk about is work with Paul Fenley and Chaitin on just a single point contact, and in particular, what happens to a single point contact as you lower the temperature. And it turns out that is actually not such a simple question to answer, but it, we believe, is answerable and is quite interesting. It has an element, a small twist, which is a direct reflection of the non-abelian aspect of the bulk topological quantum Hall state. So, you know, before delving into this, I do think an interesting sort of open set of questions would be trying to understand the edges of, you know, broader classes of topological states, chiral topological states, trying to understand the edge structures, trying to understand, you know, not only one plus one dimensional edge, but the zero plus one dimensional point contact. So each of these can be interesting in their own rights, and their behaviors are ultimately dictated by the topological character of the bulk state, or the bulk topological state. So, so we're going to be talking about, you know, the simplest state, essentially, from my point of view, which exhibits non-abelian statistics. And as you all know, it's almost all of the fractional quantum Hall states have an odd denominator because of Fermi statistics, and the Laughlin wave function M is odd, 1, 3, 5, 7. And this odd denominator is traced to the fact that the underlying particles are electrons with Fermi statistics. So it was remarkable in 1987 when an even denominator plateau was seen. This was largely ignored for various different reasons, but has been revived, you know, in large part thanks to, you know, to Mike Friedman and ultimately Bill Gates for, you know, pumping in a fair amount of money into the experimental side of this field. I mean, the quantum Hall effect in the United States had basically, as an experimental science, it almost died, you know, during the past decade, during the, you know, late 90s. And this has really revived it, and I think there's, you know, some very, you know, extremely interesting questions that, you know, these experiments that are now ongoing will be able to probe, hopefully, and answer. So, the samples have gotten much, much better, and now one sees a reasonably well-formed plateau at nu equals 5 halves. So this nu equals 5 halves state is not, you know, that much weaker than nu equals 1/3 or nu equals two-thirds, you know, the original two fractional Kolmogorov states seen. I mean, okay, so this is the Moore-Reed wave function. And now I don't know, I mean, when I sort of grew up, I grew up with field theory, and I didn't really like wave functions, you know, because, you know, how much intuition does one have, you know, looking at the many-particle wave function? It turns out in the quantum Hall effect, one can get an enormous amount of intuition by thinking about it. I mean, much more than one might have guessed. So it's been extremely useful historically in the fraction quantum Hall effect. And so this was the wave function put forward by Nick and Greg Moore. And there are two important factors. One is Zi minus Zj squared. This is basically, this would be a Laughlin state for bosons and a half-field Landau level. And then there's a Pfaffian state, which involves pairs of fermions, which are, all the fermions are paired up. You take one of the Z1 minus Z2, one of the Z3 minus Z4, and then you anti-symmetrize. This is a Pfaffian, and there's pairing going on. It's a bit like a superconductor. And indeed, this Moore-Reed state, you know, equals, on the level of wave functions, the Laughlin state times the BCS state. BCS, you know, this is Bardeen, Cooper, Schrieffer, who put down, you know, this remarkable theory for superconductivity in the late 1950s. But it's a particular BCS state with PX plus IP symmetry. All that means in this context is that if you take a pair, ZJ minus ZK, and you take one around the other, you pick up a phase factor of, you know, 2 pi, either minus I 2 pi. And so there's a P wave relative orbital angular momentum between all electrons that are in these pairs. How's it going, Yvette? So do feel free to bail. Actually, everyone feel free to bail. Sometimes I want to bail, you know, but I gather that's not good form. So, so I don't know quite how much detail to go into, but let me just go into a little bit to give you a flavor, for those who are not kinetic matter physicists, as to how one can build up a theoretical understanding of this Moore-Reed state, using just simple algebra, basically. I mean, it's, perhaps calculus. I guess one's calculus. There's some derivatives here. And maybe some elementary field theory. But, so the essence, really, the interesting part of the Moore-Reed state is the Pfaffian. It's this paired piece. And this really kind of just goes along for the ride. And so it's actually very, it's a nice simplification just to focus exclusively on the Pfaffian. And the Pfaffian, then, as I say, is the physics of a P plus IP superconductor. And then there's a 50-year history of how to treat superconductors. And Bolgiyuov and Degen were early pioneers. And they basically wrote down Hamiltonian, which described the dynamics. This is the kinetic energy of the electron, some external potential of the electron. And here's the term which is the pairing term with some strength delta. So that's, that's the delta is the cost and energy to break apart a pair. And this is a Hamiltonian which just, you can diagonalize, find all the eigenstates. And what you find is that there's a spectrum with a gap. And the gap basically is set by the pairing strength. So, and above the gap there are fermionic quasi-particle excitations, as I've shown here. But the ground state, you would take that out. That's the ground state. And that's always this thing which has been very strange for me, is that these topological states, the ground states, see you for lunch, the ground states are, all of the interesting physics of the ground state is hidden from one. I mean, it's somehow encoded in what the electrons are doing, but it comes out when one starts looking at quasiparticle excitations and maybe the edge and braiding the quasiparticle excitations and so forth. The natural ground state is just some featureless state, you know, which is very hard to get an understanding of. So I'm really motivated why one wants to look at the edge. So an edge of a BCS superconductor, and I guess by edge here I mean you take a superconducting material and you just cut it. So this is just, you know, free space. You can do that by putting a potential which forbids the electrons living, you know, out here and confines them into the superconductor. And then you can solve the Bolyai Degen equation in the presence of this boundary. It's a slightly more complicated problem because now you only have translational symmetries in one direction rather than both. Okay, but it's still, you know, very simple. And what one finds is that there's a mode, a solution, which is living actually right at zero energy, essentially right at zero energy. There's a mode which is living right at zero energy. And that is described by a wave function, which is actually a spinner. It's a two-component wave function. And it, in contrast to all the other modes, all the other eigenstates, which come in plus or minus E pairs, this one right at zero energy lives alone. Okay, so it is in some sense half of a fermion. And indeed, it's described in terms of Majorana fermions, which are operators which satisfy anti-commutation relations but are equal to their own adjoints. And one can then write down essentially a wave equation to describe the dynamics of these edge modes, which propagate with some velocity in one direction. Now things get a little more interesting when one takes a finite sample, a droplet, you know, because then the edge state runs all the way around the sample, and then one has to worry about the boundary conditions, because the wave function has to come back to itself. So it turns out that the appropriate boundary conditions are anti-periodic. So if you start with a wave function here and come around, the wave, you have to hit, you'll get a minus sign in the wave function, basically. And what where that's coming from is this this two-component spinner character of the edge modes, and which can be viewed as basically an SU2 spin a half, which is tangential to the edge, and when you rotate that spin a half, you get a minus sign. Alright. Now put in a vortex. You know in superconductors, vortices are important, they can't, you know, magnetic fields are expelled. You put it on a magnetic field, you get these flux tubes and vortices, and you know, there's a huge, you know, technological interest in those, and a lot of really interesting physics. So you can just look at a vortex in one of these P plus IT superconductors. Single vortex, put it right in the middle of this circular sample. Well, it turns out that when you take one of these fermions around a vortex, the fermion wave function picks up a minus sign. And the basic reason is that this vortex is a vortex in a pair of electrons. So if you take a pair of electrons around, you get a 2π, and that's what quantizes the vorticity. The wave function of a pair picks up a 2π. But if you just take a single fermion, the wave function picks up a minus sign. And so that minus sign combines with the minus sign one already had by doing this spin rotation, this SU2 spin, to give one periodic boundary conditions. Okay, so when you have a vortex here in the center, you have two states. You have a state at the very edge, and then you have a state running around the internal edge, you know, where you've made the vortex. And each of these states has exactly zero energy, at least when the system is large. And why? It's because they have periodic boundary conditions. So what's this term here is basically the Hamiltonian, describes the energy. When these wave functions are periodic boundary conditions, they are independent of the coordinate act which runs around the sample, and so this derivative vanishes. So a single vortex in a sample with an edge like this, there are two zero energy Majorana fermion modes. And one of them is really tied to the position of the vortex, the other one's running around the edge. Now you can combine these, you know, mathematically if you so choose, to define a complex fermion. You can take, you know, the vortex Majorana fermion plus I times the edge Majorana fermion. You create a complex fermion, and a complex fermion is a much, you know, is a simple beast. It's basically a single complex fermion. The Hilbert space that you can access has just two states. You could say no particle and one particle, you know, empty or filled, and A dagger A, you know, annihilates the state with no particle, and A dagger gives you one when there's one particle left. So it's just, it measures the number of, it measures whether that state is occupied or not, A dagger A does, right? But this is already quite interesting here because one can imagine that the vortex, the wave function going around the vortex, the Majorana mode here and the Majorana mode here going around the edge, can be entangled. And in fact, generally you would expect that they are. So that the wave function for both, for both the zero energy Majorana states could be written as alpha 0 plus beta 1, where alpha and beta can be, you know, arbitrary complex numbers, and more about normalization of state. So this is, you know, very unusual in condensed matter physics to see, well, first of all, a real robustness about, you know, finding something exactly zero energy state, and to have the possibility that, you know, a non-locality, you know, manifests itself, that the that this wave function and a wave function which can be, you know, arbitrarily far away, you can have a very big sample, are and will be generally entangled in some way, and really together form a single qubit. I mean, you can't really talk about, you know, the physics separately of these modes. I mean, you can't measure them directly. And of course, these vortices are the ones with the non-abelian statistics, right? So you can consider a bunch of vortices, not just one, and, you know, I think, you know, probably this has been gone over a number of times. You can ascribe, you know, a Majorana zero mode to each of these vortices. You can introduce a vortex operator if you like. The reason that's useful is because Majorana fermions don't have to live on top of vortices. I mean, they can. There's a zero energy Majorana fermion mode on a vortex, but you can have Majorana fermions, you know, moving around in here. You know, so the Majorana fermions and the vortices are not one and the same thing. I mean, it's they're two excitations. But if you just have the forma, you just have vortices, then there is this, you know, braiding statistics, you know, which is, you know, somewhat not trivial. And if you have n vortices, then there's n over two qubits formed in this way, and of course then you have a massively degenerate zero energy Hilbert space when you have many of these vortices. And this was, you know, this was a brilliant idea of Alexei Kateyev to use that massively degenerate Hilbert space, which has a gap to other excitations and is thus protected from noise, you know, trucks driving by and so forth, to use that Hilbert space to, you know, to perform decoherence-free quantum computation. And not only is it protected, in condensed matter physics, we quite often have a system with a gap. You know, silicon, you know, has a gap, I mean, you know, 0.2 electron volts or whatever it is. But the virtue here is that the state that one can actually get into that, it has a gap, but this is massively degenerate, and that's the unusual thing, I guess, yeah. Is that there's a gap and there's a huge degeneracy of states. And so that when you mix those states, the energy doesn't is the same, so they don't get even accumulate a relative U1 phase factor. Well, they need not. I mean, they can, but in any case, the experiment that one would eventually want to do, and I think Jayton and others probably talk about this, there is braid these quasiparticles around one another, you know, perform unitary transformations in this massively degenerate Hilbert space, and then measure things, you know, perhaps by fusing two vortices back together. In practice, probably it would be done by interference time measurements that we talked about yesterday with these multiple point contacts. And so, in fact, let me then turn to the edge. So what's interesting is when you take one of these vortices and move it off the edge, or introduce one from the edge into the bulk, okay? And in fact, that's going to be kind of, you know, in these interference experiments, that's the type of thing one would want to do. One has, one's braiding around these vortices, and then to measure them, you know, one might want to take them onto the edge, and they get washed away, and then you can measure interference and see what you had. You know, once you make the measurement, you decode here, but that's okay. We have to live with that in quantum mechanics, of course. So you can pass the vortex through the edge, and we already know that the vortex inside the bulk of the sample changes the boundary conditions from periodic to antiperiodic with these fermions. And that's really done locally. I mean, that is if you could move it through, you know, quickly, and it's not going to immediately change the boundary conditions. I mean, it will create a disturbance here. And that disturbance will propagate out. And once that disturbance propagates out and relaxes and reaches all the way around the system, and the system relaxes into its ground state, if it does so, then you would have gone from a state with periodic boundary conditions to antiperiodic boundary conditions around this whole sample. But actually, in practice, in any fractional quantum Hall effect measurement, you know, you never really want to be looking at the whole sample, because somewhere over in the part of the sample, you know, what they have is these huge gold metallic contacts, which are just, you know, have been etched and diffused right into the two-dimensional electron gas, completely destroying it. I mean, and that's where they measure the interference ultimately. So you don't want to think about the electrons along these edges or these Majorana fermions going into those contacts. And, I mean, you want to let them go in, but you don't want to have them come out. Or if they come out, they're completely decoherent. So, anyway, you can define an edge vortex operator, and we already had this edge Majorana fermion operator, and they have this particular commutation relations, which is this sign change that we were talking about, and then the vortex operators themselves have an abelian statistics. The vortex and the Majorana fermion?
No, the vortex is itself.
Yeah, so that's, okay, so that's a property of the chiral Majorana fermion when you change boundary conditions periodic to antiperiodic, and it's the, you basically have a chiral Ising model, and this is the chiral component of the spin operator, and 1/8 So there's various tricks, you know, mathematical tricks using conformal invariance to try to compute these things. You know, none of which I could ever reproduce, but I can read about them in the yellow book. And Paul and Chaitin can have many times explain them to me, and I always forget afterwards.
I'm just thinking that someone in I don't feel quite up to it, but someone should be able to say for the mathematicians that there's some kind of covering space, two-fold branch covering on this disk, and that's what these boundary conditions are, and you're changing from a trivial to a non-trivial covering space. I don't know, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what the signal field does.
So a priori, the side field, since it's not, since it's sort of an effective thing, it's not describing the fundamental electronics, it's allowed to be two values.
No, the reason even if it were describing fundamental electrons, you might want to allow it to be two values, because any observable quantity is a bilinear, any physically observable quantity would be a bilinear in the side field.
Yes.
And therefore, the physical quantities would be perfectly periodic, even if psi were antiperiodic.
Yeah, I mean, another way, I mean.
So it's an abstraction, we allow you to do the electrons, wave functions, periodic.
I would say to rephrase it a little bit differently.
It's very important that we don't change the boundary conditions on the electrons.
Yeah. The electron wave function is single value. Okay, so you might ask, how does one go from the electron to this to this side.
Yeah, I was fretting about
that. Right, well, no, exactly. And
so
that's
the different objects.
What, yeah, they're different objects. Now, what one can do, inside a superconductor, when you have no vortices, the only difference between them is a phase factor, e to the I, phi, where phi is the phase of the condensate wave function in a superconductor. But once you have currents flowing in the superconductor, and particularly when you have a vortex, so currents are flowing around, the psi and the electron become very, very different. Right, and in particular, if you do this thought experiment, which is you can do it, you can imagine doing it in a superconductor, and you can do it describing using BCS theory. And it was something that really puzzled me for many years, actually, was just take a two-dimensional superconductor infinite and put in one vortex, the nerve, and you have some many-particle wave function with the electrons as their coordinates, and they're single-valued. I mean, so you can say, well, that's fine. Let's freeze the position of all the electrons in some sort of statistical way where they like being to maximize mod size squared or a typical configuration. And then you can put a potential on, you know, to break a pair and make two electrons. And one of those electrons you could carry off really far away. And then you could drag there's two things you could do. Let me back off a second. One thing you could do is take the many-particle wave function and just follow the wave function when you take a single electron coordinate and just wind it around the vortex. And because the wave function is complex, you can avoid the zeros. It will be zeros. And so as you move that electron coordinate, the wave function will accumulate phase. And when you come back, the phase has to be 0, 2 pi, 4 pi, or whatever it is. And you can ask, what is it? Now, you might have guessed it should be pi, because this vortex is a vortex in a pair, right? And indeed, if you took a pair of electrons and took them around, you would get 2 pi, essentially always. I mean, but if you took one electron around, what happens is you will get 2 pi, 0, minus 2 pi, 4 pi, 6 pi, and it will depend in very, very much detail on precisely which path you take. And the reason for that is because the wave function, while complex, is just barely complex. So the only reason it's complex rather than real is because you've got one vortex. But far away from that vortex, it hardly knows about it. And so, you know, these point zeros in the wave function are becoming dense and almost forming lines. And you can take your electron and kind of, you know, go through, and working with the bare electrons and vortices in a superconductor is absolutely hopeless, right? It's not that they always have 2 pi and you take one around the other or pi. It's just some, you know, absolutely hopeless mess. It's some many-particle interaction. But then if you work with these psi operators, they have the virtue that, you know, whenever you take one of those around the electron, you'll get a minus sign. And the way to define a psi physically, because as physicists, one doesn't, you know, one may just have a physical state and one, you know, there we are. I mean, you don't. So what you can do, and that's what I was saying before, is you can take a potential and you know, break a pair, right, and then take one quote electron far away and take the other quote electron here. And let's say you have a gap, you know, and then you can take that and adiabatically drag it around, this, you know, electron, and ask what Berry's phase you get. Well, you get pi. You know, then you don't have to come back to, you know, the same wave function. I mean, because
what was the difference between the electron and the psi?
The electron, what I was doing was taking the many particle wave function
and breaking a pair
and just taking a coordinate in that, one of the z's, and moving it, and following the wave function. I wasn't doing anything with the other electrons at all. The second thing I'm doing is putting a potential on and letting everything readjust, and binding a single fermion. I mean, if you have spin, you could bind a single spin a half. You can't say you really bound a charge E, because you can say, but you can actually, you have to, because there's only an even odd charge, you know, the U1 symmetry of charge conservation is broken in the superconductor, so you can only talk about even odd charges, and so you want an odd charge, which is, you know, one fermion, and then there's an adiabatic process, and you come back to where you started, and you pick up a very space of pi. And so, you know, so operationally, you know, in physical terms, you can talk about such a fermion, Majorana fermion, say, which picks up which is, you know, non-local in pi statistics, or whatever you want to call it, relative pi statistics, with the vortices. Now, you know, we also know how to do this at the level of a field theory, you know, using this trick EVI phi, C is EVI phi psi, and so, you know, I think we both understand it, you know, what it means in some sense in physical terms and how to implement it theoretically. So anyway, this is something that has confused me over the years, because the electron wave function has to be single valued, and in fact, you know, many of my colleagues who are fraction quantum Hall effect, you know, real aficionados, use that fact of the single valueness of the electron wave function to put, you know, strong constraints on topological states that are allowed. That if they're made from electrons, and you know, Nick and others, Eduardo, you know, really taking advantage of that. I mean, you know, it's because it's golden. If you start with a system with electrons, the wave function of the electrons has to be single value. Okay, well, now I can just whip along. Add in nu equals 5 Hz. You know, we've talked about this, basically, you know, kind of almost all one needs to know. And then there's this factor, the Laughlin factor, which is where the actual charge of the electrons resides. In the fractional quantum Hall effect, we're not doing a superconductor. It's not a superconductor. Charge is still a good quantum number, and the electrons carry charge. And indeed, the electron wave function is single-valued. You take this Z around another Z, and it comes back to itself. You know, pick up a 4 pi. So what are the excitations now? Well, we had the same ones we had before. We have the charge zero Majorana fermion, but then we have charged excitations. This excitation was the vortex, is still a vortex, but now it accumulates electrical charge, E over 4, coming basically from this term. And you know, that's, you know, sort of a Laughlin argument that when you thread in a vortex, charge gets, you know, sucked in because of the quantized Hall conductance. So it's, and the statistics, this pi over 8 was the same pi over 8 than one had before, you know, in the commutation relations between sigma and psi. And then you have, for example, a double strength vortex. A double strength vortex is very different than a single strength vortex, because a single strength vortex is seen by, when you drag one of these Majorana fermions around, you get a pi. When you have a double strength, you get 2 pi or 0. So it's blind to a double strength vortex. So a double strength vortex is a, you know, boring old abelian semion. Okay, it has charge E over 2, and it's essentially just the Laughlin quasiparticle. I mean, it really is, that would exist. You could put in basically into this part of the wave function. Okay, so that's the bulk, and the only difference between a P plus IP superconductor and the 5 Hz edge is this, you have now have an additional charge mode. And the charge mode is just that. I mean, you really have a plasmon, you know, electric charge is vibrating and moving along with some velocity. And this charge mode velocity, one would expect it to be larger than the neutral mode velocity, but, you know, in practice, determining these velocities, which are, you know, non-universal quantities that, you know, depend on the experimental system and are things which experimentalists need to know, and we have trouble telling them. But in any case, 5 Hz has... the 5 Hz state described by the Mori wave function, the edge to the vacuum with no electrons will have then a Majorana mode with no electrical charge, you know, and then this a boson, which just describes the charge moving along the edge. I mean, the derivative of phi is the charge density. I mean, this is so we can then look at edge operators. There's the Majorana fermion on the edge. There's the vortex that one can create on the edge. One has the sigma as before, but now one has a charge of 1/4, so one has to multiply it by this, and then this double strength vortex, which in the superconductor was not really something we were interested in at all, but now just has charge of 1/2. And then, you know, the good old electron, how do you create that on the edge? Well, it's fermionic, so you have to, act with the Majorana fermion operator, and then you have to put in the electron charge. And everything always works out nicely that this is a fermion, and with charge G, it's got Fermi statistics. You can add in two electrons, like a Cooper pair, and this is the creation operator for this. Yeah, so I'd want to kind of start just focusing in quickly on the particular aspect that Chaitin and Paul and I were interested in. I mean, at this stage, it's just been hopefully somewhat pedagogical overview of things which many of you, I'm sure, understand extremely well, but probably not all. So hopefully, it was helpful to at least some. So, good enough. This is the theory of the edge. How do you actually probe the edge experimentally? Well, there's sort of three different ways to do it. There's more than this, but one which is very nice is you can tunnel in electron charge and put a contact can, tunnel electrons into the edge. And you can measure the tunneling conductance. And one can work it out theoretically, and there are two contributions, one coming from tunneling in the electrical charge and the other from tunneling in the Fermi statistics. You know, basically, when you add the electron, you shake up both the psi mode and the phi mode. And the disturbance that you create when you add in the electron, the charge that you added in scoops off, let's say, very fast, and the statistics that you added in, if you will, moves more slowly, let's say. I mean, they separate out. So the electron loses its integrity completely on the edge, and as do any quasi-particles. Once you're on the edge, the charges, there are no quasi-particles on the edge, per se. You can add electrons onto the edge, you can rip a quasi-particle, you can pull something off the edge which becomes a quasi-particle when it's in the bulk. But on the edge, there are operators, but there's no real meaning to a quasi-particle moving along the edge, basically. Another experiment people do is shot noise. In any case, that's a very nice experiment because it directly can be used to detect the charge of the quasi-particle, and usually it's in this case it would most likely be the charge of the non-abelian quasi-particle, which is 1/4. And the fact that the charge is 1/4, even though you're at a half fill Landau level, is the key signature of pairing, or at least the key signature of pairing. Now, just because you're a pair doesn't mean it's more read, but more read is paired, so you better find E over 4. And so this experiment is doable, I think, and it would be interesting. Okay, so the one we've been focusing on, partly because it's most interesting theoretically, is just a single point contact. You pinch it, you allow vortices to tunnel from one edge to the other, and you lower the temperature. And what happens is as you lower the temperature, you get more and more of these tunneling processes until you go to zero temperature. You don't get any transmission at all. You get complete reflection. And so there's this rather interesting crossover as a function of temperature, which is actually quite non-trivial in general. And this crossover is something which in the abelian quantum Hall states was examined in a fair amount of detail by Paul Fenley and Andreas Ludwig and Stuart Brothers and Ivesova
and Charlie Kane and Matthew Fisher.
These guys, did the real thing, beta ansatz and calculating exactly scaling functions which are compared to experiment. It's really quite a beautiful, success story. One of the, I think, closest connections in condensed matter physics between conformal field theory and experiment. There's been others, with a condo. I think it was a very nice story. So we basically, Chaitin, Bohr and I revisited this in the context of this non-abelian state. And very briefly, the extra complications are coming from the non-abelian character, which makes it more interesting as well. So, you allow a tunneling from the A edge to the B edge of a vortex with strength T sub V, and then you start doing perturbation theory, and you tunnel a vortex across at time one, at time two, at time three, blah blah blah, and you want to go to higher orders of perturbation theory. And if you want to understand the crossover, it's a non-perturbative effect. I mean, you really have to. The crossover is not something you can access doing perturbation theory here. You can't. The perturbation theory won't converge. I mean, so you might say, why are we doing? Well, we're doing it is because we believed that there was going to be a simpler representation which we could use to understand the crossover and to actually compute the principal non-perturbative effects, which of the crossover. So, but you do perturbation theory, and the key technical thing was one wants to do this chiral decomposition. So half of these operators live on the top edge and half live on the bottom edge, and each edge by itself is somewhat simpler, and so you can write this in a product form. But this is actually very, very tricky, and this is because of all the fact that this product of operators is not uniquely defined, because you know there's these different fusion channels. These can go to 0, 1, 0, 1. So you really have to determine the appropriate fusion channels which you have on the right-hand side of this perturbative expansion. And those are determined ultimately by going back to the original tunneling operator, which involves both the top and the bottom edge. And or the assumption is, but it's physically reasonable, is that when these fuse together, they give you the vacuum. Okay, so that then it dictates ultimately the form of the fusion channels that you have under this perturbation expansion. And you have to sum over many different fusion channels. So actually pretty democratic there. Some of them overall, basically. And that's fine. But then we realize, we definitely need clever bookkeeping. I mean, at fourth order in perturbation theory, these are, two terms in the perturbation expansion in terms of the four complex coordinates of these tunneling particles. And these are, sort of Ising model four-point functions, which, and at sixth order in perturbation theory, Paul challenged me to get this. It took me, 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah. No, it's, so I can't even, I mean, I get ill when I look at this. I mean, let alone when I manipulate symbols. So where did this come from? I guess we backed it out from knowing the bosons, or what?
Yeah, you bosons, yeah.
We used a proof of Paul to show that there's a general connection between a bosonized representation and this brute force perturbation expansion, and then you can compute these correlators using bosonization, and that is relatively simple. I mean, that's how Jaden obtained that. So very briefly, this is a technical trick. Bosonization, we take these two Majorana fermions running in opposite directions, we flip them over, and we make them move in, the top and the bottom ones move in the same direction, we then combine them to make a complex fermion, which we bosonize, e to the I phi sigma. And the Lagrangian for that boson is just a free boson. And that's fine and well. What is tricky is getting the form of this tunneling operator in terms of this boson. And this tunneling operator, which was simple in terms of these vortices, now looks interesting and slightly more complicated looking, but still rather tractable ultimately, in terms of this new boson that we have obtained by combining the two Majorana fermions. And what one sees is that there's an emergence of a spin 1/2 degree of freedom associated with the point contact. And this spin 1/2 degree of freedom basically keeps track of whether there have been an even or odd number of tunneling events. So it's encoding some sort of topological character. For those of you in condensed matter, you'll recognize this as a variant of the Kondo model. Just you have a spin 1/2 coupled to this extended boson mode, but it's actually a fermion mode. So this is really actually identical to the single channel anisotropic Kondo problem. But fine. five halves, you can likewise bosonize, and it turns out it becomes identical to a generalized two-channel Kundam model. Now, whether the crossovers can be computed for these, I don't know. I mean,
not for this one. Not for the two-channel, for that one.
Right. Really? How come?
Because it's not exactly two-channel Kundam. It's
so? Come on, Paul. You let me down. I wish I had so much faith in your ability to.
Yeah, well.
Such an exact guy.
Whatever.
So very briefly, because people are getting hungry. In some sense, this is the most theoretically, on the abstract side, this is the perhaps the most interesting part. I mean, I think it is. Although the least relevant experimentally, but there we are. So often the case that is. In fact, I die for the day when the most abstract and beautiful mathematics is relevant directly to an experiment. I mean, that's what Bob Laughlin did, and it's you get some kudos for that. So upon cooling, the weakly pinched off single drop breaks into two drops. And so there's a weak vortex backscattering here, historically called ultraviolet, coming from short distances and high energies. I guess it's high energies there. And then this, over in this limit where they break apart, sometimes called the infrared, because it's the physics is determined by lower energy physics. And there's a crossover, which is universal, actually. I mean, and this is a general feature, but what I want to focus on here is the entropy drop, the difference between the entropy of the final state and the initial state. So this is a thermodynamic entropy. So the difference between the infrared entropy and the ultraviolet entropy, which is now related to, it comes out in Ludwig and Affleck's analysis of boundary conformal field theory, and they called it a boundary entropy. And one of the things we want to do is sort of reinterpret that in terms of these topological phases, and I'll do that in the final transparency. So for the P plus IP state, this is completely trivial, because in the ultraviolet there's just a free spin flipping, so the entropy is log 2, and in the infrared that spin is completely screened and there's nothing left, and so there's a unique ground state, so that's log 1 or 0, and so the change in entropy is log 2. Drop of entropy. Log 2, you have more information at the end. Entropy went down. The two-channel Kondo problem, it turns out the change in entropy for the nucleus 5 halves is minus log squared of A. Okay, so this came out of our analysis. Now, in a sort of parallel development by John Preskill and Alexei Kateyev and Wen and Levin, if I got everybody, or not, we're studying, an extremely abstract quantity, because one I'd really never thought about, because it's pretty damn hard to measure. But in the context of these topological phases, it's a really very interesting quantity. And so, what is it? So you take your two-dimensional infinite topological state, and you focus on some region with circumference L, and you take the density matrix, which is just the outer product of the ground state wave function, and you trace out the degrees of freedom outside of this region to get a reduced density matrix, rho sub L. And then you extract the entropy from that reduced density matrix, which you would do trace rho log rho. It's just the usual definition of von Neumann entropy, I guess. But you're getting now something non-trivial, because what you're getting is somehow a knowledge of the entanglement between the degrees of freedom out here and the degrees of freedom in here. Now, there is a sort of a rather trivial a factor which is proportional to the circumference with a non-universal coefficient here, which is basically coming from short-distance physics, the bonds that you might have had to but you had to draw your line somewhere on a lattice. You would have to draw it, cut across some bonds and so forth. But then you get a, you know, rather remarkably, a universal piece, which is actually subdominant. So it's a little dicey to pull this out. But both groups, you know, I think, you know, very carefully defined how one, what we need to do to actually extract the subdominant piece. It's subdominant when L gets large. And so this is a sort of a topological measure of the entanglement. And here D is the quantum dimension, which, again, which tells us something about the degeneracy of how the degeneracy of the Hilbert space grows with the number of quasiparticles. And so the quantum dimension for this P plus IP superconductor is 2, and the quantum dimension for the nucleus 5 halves is root 8. Okay, so this is an entanglement entropy. You're at zero temperature, you're just using the ground state wave function. I mean, you're not, there's no temperature. Ground state wave function. And all you're doing really, okay, you calculate it, and you know, strictly speaking, you have to take L, you know, very large. I mean, you know, much larger than any microscopic length. So, you know, strictly speaking, you probably have to take L to infinity to really define this with absolute rigor. But we were looking at a different entropy, although evidently, you know, perhaps extremely closely related, and a thermodynamic entropy, which was a finite temperature property of these chiral edge states. I mean, so we really had these gapless edge states moving around here, and there was an entropy associated with that. And we deduced that the change in entropy when you break a drop into two, which is basically what has been done here. You take a big drop and you cut out a piece. I mean, it's and it is, well, it was quite remarkable to us at least that the thermodynamic entropy drop at this point contact going from here to there is then identical to the entanglement entropy once one uses these quantum dimensions. This thermodynamic entropy drop, which Ludwig and Affleck, identified in boundary conformal field theories when they were looking at these point contacts, but I'm not sure they had the physical interpretation that we now can suggest, which is this boundary entropy is actually can be understood if you take this point contact and consider it as a point contact which is arising from these topological phase, pinching it off, and then this entropy drop is not really a boundary property at all. I mean, it's a property, it's a global property, and the word boundary entropy, which meant really associated with the point contact, was perhaps not such a good name. Anyway, it's equivalent, thermodynamic entropy drop, what I'm calling is equivalent to what Affleck and Ludwig were looking at. But there is this rather nice connection that this thermodynamic entropy drop under this crossover, which is, one that's sort of accessible experimentally, maybe not this entropy drop, but, and the entropy of this disentanglement, which is, extremely interesting theoretically, but is, ultimately, really what one is doing here is order of limits. I mean, so here you, entanglement entropy, you go to the ground state, that is, you go to zero temperature, and then you take this region L to infinity afterwards. What we're doing here is we're taking the size L to infinity first, and then taking the temperature to zero. So it's, I'm done, basically. Let me just, so from my, very narrow perspective, some of the problems which theoretically seem like they could be interesting. Would be point contacts in other non-abelian states, like the Riemann-Zeiss state, and trying to understand those crossovers or whatever else you can try to understand from those. Or the edges, really, the edges of these other non-abelian states, particularly the Riemann-Zeiss, because there is one other plateau state in the fractional quantum Hall effect, which one might hope is a state with a state with non-abelian statistics, which is actually a universal quantum computer, as opposed to this nucleus 5R. So multiple point contacts, you know, Chetan talked about this as a, you know, an architecture you're going to want to use. You know, there are interesting theoretical questions there, though, just when you have two-point contacts and you lower the temperature and you break, you know, you isolate a drop, and you know, that drop can have, you know, even or odd number of electrons, but it, you know, there's some topological constraints on what excitations can be in that drop, and which are going to, I think, have to sort of manifest themselves in the physics of how you disentangle across two-point contacts, possibly. Non-equilibrium transport, I mean, there's a very nice work that Paul and co-workers did in the context of the abelian quantum Hall states of the point contact, you know, using Keldysh and so forth, sort of a nice technique. And then there's all the experimental side, which fortunately is actually moving. I mean, it's, so I think, I mean, what I find remarkable about this, you know, this topological quantum computing is the breadth in fields over which its practitioners reside on something, right? I mean, you know, and who generally genuinely find it interesting, from topologists and mathematicians to theoretical physicists to the most abstract side of theoretical physics, to the condensed matter theorists who like actually getting in and looking at the actual experiments, to of course the experimentalist, and then to the sample growers, the technology underlying growing these samples. I mean, it's just truly remarkable, and there's millions of dollars have gone into used for growing the spectrum of quantum Hall effect samples, and getting the ones where you might hope to see non-equilibrium statistics is extremely challenging. And there's only one person in the world, who's Lauren Pfeiffer, who works at Lucent, who can actually do them. I mean, who can actually make samples which, in which you have a prayer to probe experimentally. And he's worrying about pretty different issues than we are. Entanglement entropy to him is, he's entangled with his goddamn experimental apparatus, I'm sure, in some way. So it is a pretty remarkable cross-cultural field, and I think that's one of the things that appeals to me. I mean, that you can, for me, you can kind of look right and look left. I don't know which is right and left, but in one direction I see mathematicians who I've never been able to communicate with, and now maybe with a little bit of communication, and then some of the experimentalists who are sample growers who I can communicate with, but I probably haven't really communicated with that much, but I feel a bit more compelled to. So anyway, I think it's lunch.